Yep, right. Yeah, we're very grateful for the opportunity we get each year to speak with you. In fact, as Dennis was saying, it's a pretty wild day. Congratulations to all of you for coming out. This afternoon I was at home and at the height of the storm, watching the trees in our backyard bend almost double. I think it must be the strongest wind I've experienced in my life. I understand it was 107 kilometres per hour, one gust at Rottnest. And it reminded me that the teachings, the Mahayana teachings, say that as we die, one of the things we will experience is a great wind sweeping us away, a veritable maelstrom of wind that sweeps away the whole world. That's what it felt like to me. I thought maybe I'm getting a taste of what it's going to be like. Okay, so tonight I'm going to share a meditation with you, just some simple relaxation meditation, and then talk a little about euthanasia from the Mahayana Buddhist point of view. And Sue's going to join me and also talk about our project, our Pure Land project, where we want to build what you might call is a spiritual hospice, a peaceful and virtuous place where people who want to focus on the emotional and spiritual side as they die can spend their last few weeks. So we'll tell you where we're up to with that. Okay, so we'll start with the meditation. And after that beautiful chanting, you're probably relaxed. But what we're going to do now is put our own minds to work and just check to see just how relaxed we are. One of my teachers says that when you're guided in meditation or listening to a meditation, 50% of the work is done for you. But when you're trying to do it yourself, you've got the full 100%. So that's what we're going to do. So sit comfortably, preferably with your back straight as you can get it, not leaning against the back of the chair. And we'll start by taking 3 deep breaths. And on each out-breath, just let go. Let go of any busyness. Let go of any plans for tomorrow. Now bring your attention to the crown of your head. And pass your attention down the back of your head to your neck and your shoulders. And just check to see if there's any tension there. And if there is, just let it dissolve, let it go, drain away. We carry a lot of tension in our neck and our shoulders. Now pass your attention down the back, along your spine, checking to see if there's any tightness there. Letting it go, letting it dissolve, letting it drain away. and then down to your buttocks. Thighs and knees, down your calves to your feet. Make sure your feet are comfortable, relaxed, the toes are relaxed. Now bringing the attention once more to the crown of your head and pass it down the front of your body. Over your forehead. This is often where tension headaches begin. And then to the eyes. Try and make sure they're completely relaxed, they're not screwed up in any way. You might have to just open them, close them again. And then down through your cheeks, your face, to your mouth, jaw, tongue comfortably resting on the back of the upper teeth, mouth lightly closed. And then bring your attention down into the neck again and just check your shoulders. Even if you think they're relaxed, just relax them a bit more. Now bring your attention down the front, upper chest, heart region. Stomach. Just imagine all your major organs inside. Relaxed. And now bring your attention to your shoulders and down your arms, elbows, wrists. And finally, check your hands. We often fidget. And now think how nice it is to feel relaxed in this busy world. I should do this more often. And now for a little while we'll focus on the breath, the coming and going of the breath. breathe gently through your nose. And as the air comes in, you should be able to feel at the tip of your nostrils the air just passing through. And then on the out-breath, the air has warmed up a little and it will be harder to detect. Bring all your attention into that feeling at the tip of your nose as the air comes in and goes out. Don't let yourself be distracted. If it helps, you can count the number of breaths. See if you can get to 5 without being distracted. Sometimes we can get to 5 or 4 and then we're distracted by a sound. Instead of the sound of the wind outside just being there and we're not following it, our mind latches onto it. We lose our concentration on the breath flowing across the nose, the tip of the nostril. Every time the mind drifts away, just gently bring it back to the sensation of the breath coming in and out through the tip of the nostril. And if you lose it at, say, the count of 3, that's okay. Just start again at 1. And now think to yourself, how lucky I am to be in this sacred place and to be able to calm my mind and focus my mind just a little, just a little. I'm going to try and do this just very briefly, even taking 3 breaths during the day when I'm feeling stressed, just to take that moment and stop. So that I can bring this breathing meditation into my everyday life. Okay, thank you. Right. Well, now that we're suitably relaxed, we can talk about a subject that I guess is not very relaxing, but it is a topic that's being debated in our city at the moment: voluntary assisted dying. And what I thought I'd do is not actually address that as a topic in the legislation, but just tell you what I think the sort of majority opinion is of the Mahayana Buddhist teachers about euthanasia. It's actually a very complex and challenging subject, and one of the things I've learned is that different teachers do have different views. So what I would say is that in the end, if you feel confused about any aspect, you should check with your own teacher. What I'm going to present is what many people say is the general Mahayana Buddhist view. So we're talking about euthanasia. We're talking about putting it in the vernacular, is it okay to pull the plug? And of course, many of us have already had experience of doing this with our pets. It's a common thing that vets recommend, and the idea is that it's the best thing for the animal. It saves any more suffering. So it's not as if we're not familiar with some of this. But the first issue in euthanasia is our motivation. So if we're the one that's helping to euthanize a sentient being, we need to ask the question, why are we doing it? Are we doing it to remove their suffering, or are we doing it to remove our anxiety about witnessing their suffering? So that's a really difficult thing. Are we doing it really and truly to remove their suffering, or are we doing it because we're so upset at seeing them suffer that we can't take it anymore? And of course we give the reason that we're doing it so that they will cease suffering. But really deep down, you've got to check what your motivation is. Who are we trying to benefit? Ourselves or the person who's dying? Why do we think it brings benefit? And I'll come to that in a minute. So if you ask these kinds of questions, then you can maybe dig down and find the hidden motivation about what you're thinking of doing. And another thing that we need to realise is that people rarely ask for euthanasia if their needs are being met. If someone is feeling loved and valued, and their physical symptoms are being managed, they'll rarely ask for euthanasia. They're really rarely asked to be put down. So in terms of euthanasia, they define two types. One's called active euthanasia and one's called passive euthanasia. So active euthanasia, as you might imagine, is actively helping to end a life. And our Mahayana tradition is very clear on this: don't do it. So even though your motivation, it may be to end the suffering, and as a good motivation, that will soften the karmic consequences, but it won't get rid of them completely, and active euthanasia has karmic consequences. After all, the Buddha did say, avoid killing. So that's the first thing, that's active euthanasia. And the Mahayana Buddhist tradition is quite clear in general. There are still exceptions, as I said. So the general thing is don't do it. And a lot of people do it, and especially with their animals, their pets, and it's often based on two misconceptions. So these are fundamental misconceptions. And the first misconception is that people think experience, awareness, consciousness, the mind ends with death. And we know, of course, as Buddhists, that that the subtle level of mind continues after death. And because many people mistakenly identify the mind with the brain, they think that when the brain dies, then the mind dies. And when the brain dies, all that suffering that the being is experiencing will finish. But the thing is that the mind, or the deepest level of mind, continues. And we know there's mental suffering as well as physical suffering. So yeah, sure, at death, the physical suffering from a disease that you might have or whatever it is, that ceases. But if you've got any mental suffering, then actually at the moment of death, if you're thinking about the pain that you're experiencing and getting angry about it, for example, then that, if that's the last thought you have before you die, that will propel you, that will be the throwing karma that propels you into your next life, which will most likely be a life of suffering. So whilst the physical pain of any disease that you've got will cease at death, any mental pain that you've got could actually be magnified. So the harsh reality is that euthanasia might actually end up increasing the suffering of the being that's being put down. It's a bit like going to sleep, and if you've got bad thoughts in your mind as you go to sleep, then it's more likely you're going to have a bad nightmare. So it's the law of proximate karma, isn't it? Karma, first of all, the heaviest karma ripens, then the karma closest to death will ripen. And whatever karma ripens at the moment of death will propel you into your next life. So that's the first misconception, thinking that actually suffering ends at death. And the physical suffering from any disease or disability you have sure will end, but any mental suffering could well be magnified. So the second misconception is that all that suffering that many people experience as they approach death is meaningless. And you might have heard people say, why should I endure this pain if I'm going to die anyway? Why should I suffer so much? Why can't I end my life now and finish this? But the point is that suffering itself is not meaningless. It does have meaning. And I can tell you in my own life, the greatest suffering for me was when our son died. And out of that suffering, I wasn't a Buddhist at the time, but out of that suffering and that feeling that life was totally meaningless, I met the teachings of the Buddha. And I often think back and think, this is crazy, isn't it? But I've got my son to thank for the fact that I'm a Buddhist. Not just my son, but his death. So suffering is not meaningless. And I think many people have had the experience of coming out of a crisis with a new understanding of what's important in life. And also, suffering, as we know, as Buddhists, is actually the ripening of our own karma. And that karma, once it's ripened, if it's ripening as we die, then it's finished. That's it, we've experienced it. And we're able to experience it as human beings and have more control over tolerating it than we would if we were an animal or a hell being. So that our teachings say that it's better that you finish that karma in this life as a human being. And so when it's finished, then you're purified, at least of that karma. So there's a purification process goes on as we tolerate suffering, and we actually can make spiritual progress. So the suffering that we experience in this life, and particularly before death, it's not meaningless. It's the ripening of our karma, and if we can tolerate it and benefit and realize what's happening and why we're experiencing it, then we make progress spiritually. So this whole idea about purifying karma with the suffering at death is very important. And you'll know from the teachings that you can purify karma either through meditation or through actually experiencing it. So someone who endures that suffering around death with equanimity is experiencing it and purifying themselves and progressing. So with active euthanasia, you actually lose that opportunity. If you think of it in a way, it's an opportunity. And the Dalai Lama says, in his words, your suffering is due to your own karma, and you have to bear the fruit of that karma anyway, in this life or another, unless you find some way of purifying it. So in that case, it's considered better to experience the karma in this life as a human being, where you have more abilities to bear it in a better way, than, for example, an animal who is helpless and can suffer even more because of that. So instead of trying to end suffering by ending life, what we should try and end is our inappropriate relationship to suffering. And with a proper relationship, the pain remains, but you've infused it with meaning and you've used it to purify. Actually, the other day I was talking about pain and learning to tolerate suffering, and we often think of pain as the most important part of suffering. I was weeding in the garden, because everything grows beautifully at this time of year, including the weeds, and I disturbed a nest of ants, and they were not happy. And in a fraction of a second, I had ants in my pants, I had ants everywhere, and they were not happy. They were biting me. And I was just about to lose it completely, and I thought, oh, really? Each bite is not actually big deal. It's just a little prick, really. And what am I complaining about anyway? Crikey, if I was in the hell realms, the pain would be ongoing and so intense I wouldn't be able to think. This, you know, and all of a sudden I found I could tolerate the pain, and I really felt that I'd made some progress in understanding what they mean by equanimity and tolerating suffering. So finally we come to passive euthanasia. I mentioned there was active and passive. And as you might imagine, passive euthanasia is actually allowing somebody to die a natural death. If someone's in a coma or someone's being kept alive by artificial means, the decision often has to be made, do we stop this? And of course, once you've started it and you're keeping the person alive, even if it's artificially, it's very hard to stop it because you know they'll die. However, most of the teachers say, no, there comes a point eventually when it's okay to stop the artificial means of keeping the person alive. And because now that we have palliative medicine, which means that the emphasis is on keeping your pain under control and letting you experience a natural death, and they're quite sophisticated now in the way that they can control pain without sending you completely to sleep, so that you've still got some ability to think. Because of those advances in palliative medicine, there's less need to even think about euthanasia. And in terms of stopping some artificial means that's been put in place, I always think of a dear friend of mine who was a nun. And she had a terrible stroke, and she couldn't swallow or speak. And so they thought with a few exercises she might learn to swallow again. So while they were trying to give her therapy, they put a peg in a stomach and started feeding it through a stomach. But once it had been put in, nobody, and even though the therapy didn't work, and she was being kept alive by feeding her through the stomach, the family found it very hard to stop doing that. And it wasn't a very, very nice time because, well, I won't go into those details, but anyway, at the end, they decided enough is enough. We're going to stop feeding her through this peg. And the funny thing is that as soon as they made that decision, she knew, of course, and she was having trouble communicating, but she brightened up totally. She became much more relaxed. And she spent her last week very peacefully, whereas the previous almost 12 months had been quite traumatic. So sometimes you have to pull the plug, but what you're doing is allowing the person to die a natural death. That's passive euthanasia. You've artificially kept them alive. You began this process, so by terminating it, you're allowing them to die naturally, and sometimes, as in this case, the patient might even prefer that. So that's about the position that I wanted to talk about tonight, of the Mahayana Buddhist view. And as I said, it does vary from one teacher to another, and in the end, you have to consult your own teacher and follow their advice. So we will have some questions, but did you want to speak first? It's a better...
Perhaps if we have questions at the end.
Yeah, at the end. Yeah, okay. So I'm going to introduce Sue. As Dennis mentioned, Sue is a member of the Buddhist Society of WA, and our committee is an ecumenical committee. Because we want to make this centre open to Buddhists of all traditions. And what's more, we're going to need support in terms of volunteers to help run the centre from more than the Hayagriva group. And so we have a mixed committee, and Sue's going to tell you a couple of the things about where we are at the moment.
Everyone, it's great that you could come tonight. And my job is to just explain the Pure Land Project, which started with Len and others at Hayagriva. And actually, I joined in because they came here one Friday night and explained about it. So I learned about it. And this is when I was working. It was years ago. And as I was still working as a health professional, and I thought it would be a good thing for my retirement. So here I am retired, and I'm helping them with it. So this project is to develop a care home for people who are at the end of their lives and who want to spend time dying in a spiritual environment. It's envisaged as a house where we will provide volunteer staff and professional staff. We would have a manager who's looking after things, but we would also have volunteer help. We hope that the house will be spacious enough to allow emergency access with stretchers and ordinary access for disabled people in wheelchairs, disabled access into the shower and bathroom and toilet and that sort of thing. We hope there'll be a nice garden so that you can look out and see something beautiful. We hope that we will be able to have enough volunteer staff who are interested to help us. And then we would be open to not just Buddhists, but people of any religion or no religion who want to spend time peacefully dying in a spiritual environment with people who understand about death. There wouldn't be an atmosphere of fear or trying not to die or trying to hang on to life, but just letting life develop the way it must. because of the legislation changes that look as if they may take place, we thought we'd better confront fairly early what we wanted to do with our centre, because of course there'll be people, if it becomes legalised, who might want to come to the centre and put an end to their lives. And because we're Buddhists, we, as Len has explained, we're aware that putting an end to your life doesn't end your suffering. So we don't want our centre to be used by people who put an end to their lives, but people who really want to continue their death as long as it needs to continue. I guess we're aware that, apart from the things that Len's been discussing about the suffering that we need to go through as our karma ripens, there's also the fact that actually death is really a golden opportunity, if you think about it. If you just had time when you were dying to just relax and be at peace in a good place, there's an awful lot of putting things to right that you can do. You can actually make peace with things that you've done wrong. You can apologize that you did wrong. Even if the people are not there, it doesn't matter. It still works. You can forgive people that did wrong to you. You can empty your heart of bitterness and regret and recrimination and die in a peaceful state, in a state of grace. So it's really a wonderful opportunity for people who understand. That's what we want to offer. So this started with nothing, of course. It's like a cottage industry. It started with nothing at all. And we have got a good team of people. We have now got a constitution. We've got our rules set up. We've got our model of care. The model of care describes the sort of care that we'll offer and all the detail about how it should be offered, all the standards that we'll need to meet in looking after the people, how to keep them safe, all our kind of risk assessment and risk management, our care for the patient, our care for our staff, all those sort of things. We're now a not-for-profit organization. We're registered. And we're getting, we haven't got our house yet. We've had a bit of a disappointment. We did receive an offer of a great house that was going to be available, and it was set up for somebody's aged parents. So therefore, you know, all the ramps and the big wide entry to the shower and everything had all been taken care of. Plus it had a lovely garden, but it's no longer available due to circumstances beyond everybody's control. So we're still looking. So if you know somebody with a beautiful house they really don't need, we'd love to hear about it. Because what we're going to be doing is to run a pilot project for 2 or 3 years first before we decide whether or not this is actually going to work. We need to know exactly what the costs will be. We're only estimating costs at the moment. We also have to know if we'll get enough volunteers who'll be interested to maintain an interest and help us all the time instead of just losing interest and disappearing. And we need to know if there's enough interest in the community in using the service, although I get the impression from what I've heard that actually there is quite a lot of interest. People are interested in that. So we need a house and we need money. We have some money, in fact. We're not completely impoverished, but we do continue to need donations. We'll be fundraising. We're planning to run a raffle in the not-too-distant future with a really good prize. So as soon as you hear about this raffle, I do hope you will pitch in and buy a ticket because we'll be letting everybody here know about it. So our idea is to get enough funds to run for a couple of years and see how it goes. And we hope by that time we'll know if it's really a goer and we can actually do it permanently. I hope that it is. I'm sure that it will, actually. I'm quite sure that it will work in the long run. So we'll be coming here regularly to tell you our updates. Since we came last year, we're in a lot more of an actual concrete shape than we were before. Having become a not-for-profit organization, we can raise funds a lot more easily. I think that's all I need to tell you about. I've said that it isn't just for Buddhists, it's for people of any religion or no religion, just people who want a spiritual environment to die in. And that we haven't got premises yet, but we're still looking. So perhaps if I ask if people have questions.
Do you want to say about?
Yeah, this goes back a few years, and we haven't run one recently. But what we did was to set up a series for people who wanted to look after a dying relative and weren't quite sure how to do it. And we ran these training sessions on a Saturday afternoon for 10 months, actually, 10 different sessions. We had about 40 people register and 27 graduated, which I thought was very good after 10 months. We had a lot of fun. People used to say, "You mean you go on a Saturday afternoon to talk about dying?" They couldn't quite get their heads around that or believe that actually we came away smiling. Yeah, so we want to, there will be an educational part to what we're doing, and we will be providing classes in this little centre that we're building for those people and the families, for example, of the person who's dying and carers who want to learn a little bit more about dying and how to care for somebody who's dying.
I might just mention that I've been to some of the death cafes around Perth, and just for interest, really, because you learn an awful lot. But listening to some of the people who go there, some of them are dying. They've got terminal illnesses. And some of them go along with their partner. And what struck me, some of them are obviously a bit lost. They may not, you know, I can think of a particular person. She was so able to talk about it and so logical about everything. But her husband was like a cat on hot bricks, really. You could tell he was very not at peace. And I would think that our facility would be great for somebody like that, because our society doesn't cope with death very well in most cases. People are afraid of death, and they don't even think about it. They want it to go away. And of course, the one thing we can all depend on is that we're going to die. And even saying that in some company gets you some very funny looks, as if, you know, you've said something radical. But I think to be in a place that we envisage with people who can easily talk about death and who are not worried about it and can answer people's questions will be a real blessing for people who don't have a religion and who don't have any spiritual beliefs and have never talked about this and are scared of the unknown and don't know how to handle it. They just don't have a view on the subject. They don't have any beliefs. And yet here it is bearing down on them. So I think we can really help in a tremendous way for people like that who actually haven't got any beliefs at all. I think that would be one of our big contributions, actually. Any questions?
Thank you. Thank you, Lynn and Sue. I'd just like to talk about a little bit about my experiences about death with my family, my parents. First of all, my father had a ulcer in his throat and he nearly died. Of course, he couldn't swallow. They put a peg in. But fortunately, he recovered. That was about 3 years ago, and he's 95. He actually took the peg out himself in the end because he just wanted to live. So, you know, that was a wonderful experience of his wanting to live, even though he was going through incredible suffering. Now, my mother was the opposite. She had a terrible stroke. She fell over. We found her fallen over with a stroke in terrible pain, and she wanted to die. She actually recovered a bit in hospital and she said, "I'm in so much pain, I want to die." And we had to watch her for 5 days, just in terrible pain, with no medication. They gave her morphine to help, but it wasn't enough. And it was just terrible. And I was going to... I've already spoken to the parliamentarians, some of them, about my mother's experience and how much I felt euthanasia was needed, because her suffering was just... She was 85 and she begged to die. And then she had another major stroke. And look, she was just... It was just the most agonising thing. But tonight, you have helped me to understand a little bit more about maybe I've cleared, I've helped my mother, well, no, my mother's helped me to clear my karma and to clear her karma, watching the terrible suffering. And I now am thinking differently about the euthanasia, the whole concept of, you know, a sister dying. I'm not. I wanted to actually be involved in newspapers and things like that, letters saying that I felt it was absolutely necessary. But I feel differently from what you've shared tonight. But I also had a son that died, and yeah, the pain was incredible. So maybe I won't have a painful death because I've experienced so much watching and suffering. Because I, yeah, thank you. That's, yeah, thank you for tonight.
I think it's a good idea to say a word about the legislation, about the fact that people want to make it legal to end someone's life. Although I'm a Buddhist and my view is that it's not a good decision, I'm aware that other people don't have those beliefs and they think it is a good thing and they can't understand the idea that it would be a good idea to go on suffering. And just because I don't think that's the right attitude, I think it's in people's interests that they have a choice, because the feeling that somebody's controlling you and won't let you do something that you want to do is quite heavy and makes people feel powerless. And if they have a choice, they're more likely to choose something which is more beneficial because it's their choice. If there's that open door and they feel I can go anytime I want, but actually I won't go just yet because maybe there are things I've got to do, maybe I've got to, and you know, the things that weigh on your mind, maybe I better sort things out, maybe I better see so-and-so and say I'm sorry about this thing that happened 20 years ago. You know, there are things that we can all sort out, then things you can apologize for. So I think my feeling is we shouldn't make people criminals for making a decision like that. That's the problem. They're actually criminals if they commit suicide or kill someone else. Whereas if it's not a crime and you can simply make an intelligent choice, you're much more likely to calm down about the whole thing and just get a perspective and make your decision the best way for yourself. And even if we think it's the wrong decision, it's their decision. I'm not in favor of people being criminals because they helped somebody they love to end their life. I don't think that's criminal. It might not be the best thing to do. I can understand the authorities being concerned about abuse of the law so that people can be murdered and it can be used as an excuse. So they obviously have to make sure the legislation is safe. But I do think it might be beneficial if people have more freedom and openness and can make their decision. And as long as people like us are around and can point out things, I think the main thing when someone is dying really is coming to terms with the things that you haven't come to terms with, apologizing for things you did wrong, forgiving people. It's the same thing. As you forgive, forgiveness flows back to you and you become able to forgive people and able to accept the suffering they caused you without rancor, without being angry with them. It's very important to do that in death. And that's the message I think that's good to pass on to people. I can see
scaring the hell out of people by saying, you know, that death won't end your suffering. I mean, that's very heavy to put that to people who are in pain. But to say you could really use this experience for something positive is pretty important. That's what I think we can offer people, to make it a really good experience. Because if anybody's been listening to Ajahn Brahm's talks over the last 20 years or so, you will be in no doubt that mind is not the same as brain. And even if you're unconscious, the mind can still be working. So just because your dear one is lying there unconscious and you think, why does she have to drag on like this? She's dragging on like that, or he's dragging on like that, for a reason. There's a good reason why they're dragging on like that. They may well be doing a lot mentally that you don't realize. People's minds do go on, even when their body doesn't.
Yeah, can I just respond to that? Because that's very true with my mother. My mother was a very tortured soul, and it was a very difficult life with my mother. And those 5 days gave us, me, time to actually massage her and love her and forgive myself and forgive her. And so, yes, that wouldn't have happened if she had died straight away. So thank you. Yeah, yeah.
I just wanted to say thank you. Very brave of you to share all that, and it's a lovely story.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, just before we do, different microphone this one. Well, just before we do finish tonight, I'd certainly like to thank Len and Sue for just the insights. I think tonight's been a wonderful night, actually, and I'm very, very pleased that we've captured all that on tape and that will go out onto the net. So that will certainly, I think, help many, many people. I think that you're coming along tonight, as Virginia has so eloquently said. You've kind of, I think, explained and helped us really understand a lot more clearly about just what death is, and maybe it's not quite as frightening as we might all think about, and especially when we come to the realization too that we've done it many, many times before. So thank you for you both, and maybe we can show our appreciation with a round of applause. And for those of us finishing, we can just pay our respects to the Buddha, Dharma and the Sangha. Thank you. I'm sure that that both Len and Sue will be around for a little while, so if you'd like to come and just ask any questions, I'm sure that they'd accommodate you.